going on, everybody? Welcome back to another podcast episode of Closing the Deal. I am your host, Sam Enright.
And I am Zach Dixon.
Hope you guys are all having a great day today. Guys, we have a very, very exciting podcast to bring to you guys. We are going to be covering the topic of how to buy a home. This is going to be a massive overview of basically from point A to point whatever point it is, point Z, I don't know, but there's several steps along there. So we're going to cover all of those, not necessarily in depth, kind of just an overview of everything. And then maybe, you know, spurn off into some other podcast episodes covering each topic in depth. But how you doing today, Zach?
Fantastic. Not too bad. Sun is shining outside. Looks like a beautiful day out there.
Absolutely. Can't ask for much else in the winter in Ohio. You know, sun does not come out very often.
It is technically still fall.
Yeah, I guess. Basically, when the temperature drops, I base my seasons off of temperature, and when it goes below a certain temperature, that's when we're talking winter now.
Agree with you there. Definitely agree.
Yeah. So, winter in Ohio, not ideal. We'll be seeing this weather for another few months.
It could be like the Alaska. I don't know if you saw that Alaska town. Literally, the sun set in November, like last week, and literally will not rise again until January 28th. So it could be worse.
Yeah. No, I've seen those little videos of like the sun and the earth rotating, and just like where it stands on the point like this, you just watch it just go like this. It's just dark all the time. It's actually insane. Like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no sun out. That would be tough.
Very tough.
All right, guys. Well, let's go ahead and get into it. So, Zach, what do you think the first part of the home buying process is? Where would you say people need to get started?
I think it starts with getting in touch with the right team, getting in touch with the right real estate agent, getting in touch with the right lender. Getting started without doing any of those things, it's kind of, you're just kind of leading down a path of nothingness. Unfortunately, you're not really going to get very far without those, you know, two people that are going to be behind you throughout the entire process. So finding those two people, I think, is first step and is key for sure.
Yeah, I agree. We see a lot of clients, I feel like, start with just typing in Realtor or Zillow.com and, you know, going through the listings and those sort of things and saying, oh, I'm interested in seeing this house. And then you get linked up with maybe the listing agent on that or, you know, whatever the case may be. So I definitely agree. Getting in touch with the right team. You know, I think in most cases, reaching out to a lender first and foremost is not normally a thought for most people, just because obviously, realtors are the ones listing the properties that when you type in realtor.com, you would think that maybe that's the first step in the process because those are the people, with their information right there. But definitely getting in touch with the right team and getting started on what I would say the pre-approval process would be kind of where I would start as well. So Zach, what do you think? I know you touched on getting in touch with the right team. What does a good team do for you in your opinion?
Well, as a real estate agent, from my side of things, your real estate agent is going to go to bat for you in any situation throughout the entire process, whether that's pre-contract or whether that's once you get into contract. So basically, that's going to be your team captain. You know what I mean? It's going to lead you to seeing the property, going to lead you in terms of writing the offer, going to lead in terms of making sure everything after contract is in order, making sure, you know, everything is going smoothly. And so from a real estate agent standpoint, just making your buyer feel more comfortable, making your buyer feel, you know, that they're going to go through the process and nothing's going to go wrong. Obviously, there may be things that go wrong in the process, but obviously giving that confidence and is key to the client. So.
Yeah. No, I think you touched on something great right there. There are going to be hiccups in the process. That is one of the biggest things is that, you know, this is a very large purchase. And unlike other purchases that you may make or other loans that you may get, you know, I know we've all had the experience of going in. You know, I remember, you know, 6 years ago, I went to check out a new car and I went into the auto dealership, and most of the time you're going to walk out with that car that day. In most cases, unless you're like kind of on edge about it or whatever the case may be, but you can literally walk into a car dealership and walk out that day with a car. That is not going to happen with a home. So let's just, I guess that's the first expectation that should probably be talked about, is that this is a much longer process. So I love what you said about, you know, having a great real estate agent. You know, we have a lot of clients that work with real estate agents, and I do think that it definitely changes the process for them. Being linked up with a professional who can walk you through all those steps, it makes the process a lot easier than doing, you know, for sale by owners or trying to attack it by yourself. Not saying it can't be done, but obviously we have real estate agents. We have professionals in the business for that reason, to help guide you along that process. So as for me, what it means to have a good lender by your side. You know, first and foremost, we're going to go through everything from the beginning. We're going to talk about your different loan options. You're going to know and going to be able to shop with confidence. And when you go out and look at homes, you're going to have an idea of where that payment range is going to be in, you know, what you can afford, those sort of things. And I'm always going to be open lines of communication. I think that's one of the most important things in this business, is open lines of communication, being honest when problems do arise, and just kind of being upfront with you in the beginning. If you think your budget should be $400,000, but on paper it should be $200,000, you know, we're going to have that tough conversation or whatever the case may be. And that's what you get with working with the right team, with the right lender, is honesty, communication, and setting you guys up for obviously what is going to be best. You know, we try to present as many options as possible. You know, some clients fit in certain buckets, some clients can fit in all buckets. You know, it's just the nature of the business. And so we go through all that and talk about those things in the beginning, and it helps greatly down the line. So
yeah, and kind of picking back off of your car buying example, when you go into a dealership, you know, who's by your side, helping you make those decisions based on the things that they're giving you, kind of you know what I mean? It's just you. So having two additional people on your side, looking at everything that, you know, the other party is presenting to you, looking at the properties as a whole, you know, just looking at all of the details, having two additional sets of eyes, especially professional sets of eyes, makes all the difference in the process. You know, just going through it yourself is definitely going to be kind of difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So guys, with that being said, you know, where do you go from there? Once you pick your team, you know, once you get linked up with a real estate agent, once you choose a lender, where do you go from there? Well, most normally, you would go into the pre-approval process. You know, the pre-approval process can be a little bit extensive, just depending, you know, client to client, but just as a general overview, you know, what does that look like for you? In most cases, you're going to complete a loan application. Each lender is a little bit different. We at our company, we have an online app that you go through. Everything's done electronically. You fill it out, and it comes directly back to us. From there, we're going to run a soft pull on your credit. So we're always going to check and see, you know, where's credit at. You know, if you're a client that needs a little bit of credit help, you know, that's something we can discuss with you in that beginning stage and say, hey, here's the steps that you need to complete in order to get your credit in a place to buy. If you're somebody who already has credit in a good spot, you know, the next thing we're going to look at is going to be your income. It's going to be credit as well. You know, what liabilities do you have each month? You know, how many payments do you have? And kind of start to take a look at those debt to income ratios and see what makes sense, you know, for you. And after that, we're going to run your loan through what is called the AUS, the automated underwriting system. So most lenders run their loans through an automated underwriting system, and then that is what their underwriters underwrite to. So as long as you can get that underwriting system to be approved eligible or whatever the case may be, whatever those findings are, that's what we underwrite to. And then from there, we'll issue a pre-approval letter. So, you know, you'll get that letter at hand, and then that is when you would take it back to Zach and say, hey, I spoke with my lender. I'm pre-approved for such and such amount with such and such loan. You know, what can we start looking at? And then Zach will kind of take it from there. You know, what is that next step process look like, you know, once the pre-approval process is complete?
For sure. Can we clarify a couple things in that, in your section there?
Absolutely.
So what exactly is a soft pull on credit? Could you explain that to the listeners a little bit?
Yeah, so a soft pull is just going to be a non-hard inquiry. So if you guys are familiar, which I'm sure most of you are, Credit Karma, Experian, those sort of apps that you use, the reason you don't get inquiries on them all the time is because they do soft pulls on your credit. So that is essentially what we would be doing in this case. The reason that most lenders will do that is because, one, credit pulls cost money. And so, you know, let's say you're below the threshold. Let's say, you know, we need credit score typically around 600. Let's say you're around mid fives. You know, we don't want to pull a full tri-merge if you are going to be a 500 borrower. We'll do a soft pull and then kind of discuss, hey, here's what we're seeing. Here's some issues that we can work on. Here's some things that we can improve, not only to keep inquiries off your credit, but also keep the cost of doing a credit pull down. So, you know, that's kind of the main reason for the soft pull, is to keep inquiries, and vice versa. You know, if you are maybe an 800 credit score borrower and you don't want inquiries on your credit, you know what I'm saying? We'll do that in that case as well, because, you know, most of the time when you're an 800 borrower, you're going to have, you know, really no issue qualifying for whatever it is. So we'll do a soft pull, kind of get a look at what the liabilities look like, and we'll go from there to keep that inquiry off until further down the line, either when you're in contract on something or when we need to formally run the automated underwriting system for you.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think the other thing that I had wanted to just maybe clarify for the listeners is talking about, you know, income and credit. What exactly goes into that, and how do those things determine, you know, how you're able to buy a home?
So income and credit work together in, there's something called a debt to income ratio. So there's a front end debt ratio, there's a back end debt ratio. And this is something obviously that we'll go into a little bit more in depth, but just kind of as a basic outline, your front end debt ratio is your housing payment, your proposed housing payment divided by your monthly income. Each loan program has a set percentage that they will not allow over that. So for example, USDA, unless you're an approved eligible borrower, they will not allow you to go above a 29% front end debt ratio. So what you would do is you would take whatever your proposed monthly payment is. Let's say it's 1400. Let's say your monthly income is 5,000. You would divide 1400 divided by 5,000. You would get that percentage. As long as you are under that threshold, you have obviously a good chance of being approved. So those are the first components of getting a pre-approval, is looking at debt to income ratios. Again, each loan program is different. Your back end debt ratio is your proposed monthly housing payment with your monthly liabilities included. So everything on your credit. So if you have, you know, two auto loans, if you have several credit card payments, whatever the case may be, we always go off minimal. So, I mean, if you're making $200, you know, a month credit card payments, but your minimum payments are $50 a month, we only hit you for the 50, you know, we don't hit you for what you're actually paying. And so you take both those numbers combined. So let's say you're 1400, and let's say you pay $500 a month in monthly liabilities, $200 car, $300 in other credit card payments. So now your total monthly payment is 1900 divided by that 5,000. You get a percentage on that back end as well. So those are the two keys right there, front end and back end debt ratio. Again, each loan program is a little bit different. USDA, their normal numbers are 2941. You can stretch them a little bit to 3243. And then FHA is the highest of all the debt to income ratios. They'll allow for up to 56% back end, and conventional will allow for up to 50% back end. So, in easier terms, basically most normal cases, you can afford the most house with conventional or, with FHA because of that high end back debt ratio that they allow for. So
awesome. Yeah, I appreciate that, because I think I've dealt with clients in the past to where they maybe have a monthly rent payment of X amount of dollars, and they are trying to have that exact same mortgage payment, and it may not work with their debt to income ratios, even though they're making that monthly rent payment each month and have not any problems with it, but they it just doesn't fit into their monthly debt to income ratio. So just some different things there for sure.
That is something we do see a lot of. And unfortunately that does not translate to buying a home. When you rent a property, you know, I'm not sure. I don't deal with property rentals or anything like that, but I would imagine they have their own set of rules and what they'll allow for. And it may not be as derivative on debt to income ratio as it is, you know, have you ever had any late? So they'll take a credit pull, you know, have you ever been late? You know, they may not care as much. Obviously, I don't think, you know, if they take a look at your pay stubs, they're not going to allow you to, you know, rent for 100% of what you're making each month, but they don't necessarily have those same guidelines as what, you know, your conventional loans, what your FHA loans, USDA, VA, you know, all of those loans have. And, you know, a lot of people will look, you know, lender to lender and think that that's just our rules. That's not our rules. We are governed by different bodies who set forth their own guidelines. And so in those cases, you know, FHA doesn't want you, you know, having a payment that's over 56% of what you're making each month combined with your, you know, with your debts. And in most cases, you know, in most people, that's not something you want to do anyways, is get that close to up there. Now, you know, there's different situations, nuances, and things that we'll discuss down the line of when that may make sense. But that kind of, you know, helps answer that question a little bit.
Definitely. And I can confirm that too, as being on the property management side myself, we do not do that vigorous of underwriting when we're doing a rental application. Usually we're looking for a decent credit score. When I say decent, I really mean decent. And you know, just a 3x gross month income. So basically, whatever the rent amount is, we're looking for 3x that each month in income. So, and those are pretty much our only stipulations. So, very, very different from the home buying process for sure.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. any other questions about the pre-approval process? You know, again, something that we will cover more in depth. I would like to obviously touch on each of those things. But again, you know, we're trying to keep this podcast as just kind of a basic overview. So don't want to take up too much time, you know, going into the nitty gritty of everything for you guys. So
for sure. I definitely appreciate you answering those questions for me. Moving on to the house hunt. Once you get that pre-approval letter, it is pretty much go time in terms of the house hunt. So basically, we'll use those numbers that we're given from our lender, and we're going to be able to determine what our market is in that specific area. And a lot of the debate that I see with home buyers, and we kind of mentioned it a little bit in the intro, is how do we find homes? A lot of people, their first step is to type in Zillow.com or Realtor.com and find homes that way. But I try to caution clients on using those sites because of the timing on which these sites use. Unfortunately, in hot markets, properties can go on the market and be off the market just as fast. And so when you're using Zillow.com and Realtor.com, those sites do not update right away. So you may be on there on a Thursday, taking a look at properties that you want to see on the weekend. But that property actually went into contract on Tuesday, but you didn't know because Zillow.com and Realtor.com don't always update right away. So us as real estate agents, we have access to something called the MLS, the Multiple Listing Service. And basically that is only accessible by real estate agents in our market. So it is exclusive for us and all of that information is in real time. So if a property goes into contract at 12:01 on Thursday, by 12:02 on Thursday, we're going to be able to see that on the MLS. And you'll actually get updates if you would like to have that done as well. You'll have updates in real time from the MLS in regards to listing status of specific properties. So I always get started with clients by getting them on a automated search on the MLS. Basically, what it will do is send you listings every single morning of properties that have come on the market that fit your buy box, all of the things that you want, whether that's bathrooms and bedrooms, whether that's a garage, whether that's a backyard, basement, all of the above, you name it. We can put all of those things in there and you'll get an automated email each morning with all the listings that are presently on the market with those things. So it's very, very easy to use. And the fact that they come directly to your email every morning is awesome because, again, you just can get on there each morning and check it out. And if you want to schedule a showing, all you need to do is send me a text, shoot me, or, you know, give me a call and we'll be able to get out there that same day or whenever you're available. So MLS is super easy to use and I love to use it for sure. Other ways that you know buyers are starting to see listings, you know, technology is coming quick and fast in pretty much every single industry here. So I've seen, you know, I've seen buyers be able to look at listings on the TV. You know, there's apps now on your TV to where you're able to scroll through listings as you're watching TV. It's absolutely crazy. But obviously, like I mentioned, being able to have that monthly or that, you know, daily email update is key, especially in a hot market, having to move fast on things. You need to have this information in real time and be able to see those things. So.
Absolutely. That sounds like that sounds awesome. I know from personal experience, I can just say that I did get set up on a drip campaign with you on the MLS, and it really does come over in real time. You get emails. It's very convenient. Be able to jump in and just take a look at those. Obviously, like Zach said, fit any parameter you're looking for, which is obviously a conversation I'm sure you have with them at the very beginning is, hey, what are you guys looking for? Because every client's different. You know what I mean? And, you know, maybe you have kids or maybe you have animals and you need a backyard and those sort of things, you know, that come up. And so the MLS is great for tailoring those things specifically to what you want and getting your real-time updates. So that's huge.
And definitely. And sometimes on Zillow.com too, like you mentioned earlier, there are agents listed on those properties that aren't necessarily even the listing agent or have zero affiliation to the property as well. So when you're calling the phone number that's listed on a Zillow listing, it's not always going to be the correct party. It may be some agent that, you know, bought an ad for that property that they are now getting all the phone calls from prospective buyers. So it's just, there's a lot of different information on Zillow.com and Realtor.com that can be misleading. And so having that access to the MLS can be crucial for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That actually reminds me of something that I wanted to talk about kind of with the Realtor and Zillow debate is, you know, you see a lot of clients, especially when they start there and you go down to the proposed payment section. If you don't read the fine print, you'll find out that all of that's based on a conventional loan at 20% down. So, you know, when you go and look at that payment and you come to me and say, hey, you know, you're quoting me this payment, why is this so much higher than Realtor.com or Zillow.com? Well, you know, if you are pre-approved for an FHA loan at 3.5% down and you're not putting 20% down, there's going to be mortgage insurance involved. There's going to be other factors, not to mention your loan amount's going to be far greater at 3%, 3.5% down than what it would be at 20%. So it's another issue that we see clients run into is, you know, you can get on there and that's, I feel like a reason that a lot of people think that these homes are in their budget is because when you do get on Zillow, you do get on Realtor and you start scrolling, you're like, oh my gosh, I could afford this payment. I could do this. And if you're not careful and don't read that fine print, you know, you could get caught up in a situation where, you know, you'd have to put 20% down and maybe you don't have that. So something else to look out for. Like Zach said, I mean, these, you know, these websites are like a lot of things in life, you know, meant to catch your eyeballs, meant to get attention. Not all of the information on there is always accurate and can be a little bit misleading. Just trying to drive engagement and trying to drive, you know, you picking up that phone and, you know, making those calls, those sort of things. So
ultimately, those companies are for profit companies. Ultimately, that's their goal is to make money. So they're easy to use, but not always the best to use. So.
Absolutely.
Moving on. So if a client has now found a property on the MLS that they want to go see, how does that process get started? Basically, what they'll do is they'll shoot me a text, give me a call and let me know that they're interested in seeing the property and I can have a showing scheduled in 2 minutes from there. Basically, it'll be around the client's availability. Usually listings have availability 7 days a week from, you know, either 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., 8 p.m. on the nighttime. So usually there's a lot of different options in terms of being able to go see the property. And lately, you know, in the last 5 years in this hot market, we've had to drop everything and go see properties as soon as they come on or as soon as the clients go see it. I think that's going to start to change a little bit moving forward. But it has been a little bit of a curveball with clients in the past 5 years or so, you know, just again, literally dropping everything that moment as soon as you see a property and going and driving out there to see it. So kind of what you've had to do to secure a property in this market. But when you're doing that walkthrough, what is the main thing? What are the main things that you're looking for? Basically, before we get out there, we're going to be taking a look at the residential property disclosure, which pretty much 95% of all home sellers are required to fill this out. The only exceptions are when a property is an estate. So if somebody is a property has moved on to probate and the new homeowner has never lived in that property, they obviously cannot make a determination on condition, things of that nature. So what's filled out on the residential property disclosure is basically any issues that the home seller has had in their homeownership. So if there's been any roof leaks, if there's been any plumbing issues, if there's been any issues with the foundation, they need to disclose all of those things. And so basically, when we decide that we want to go see a property, we're going to go look at that first and foremost to make sure to see what's on there, what we need to be looking for. And so if we see on there that there's been a roof leak in the last 5 years, we're going to go check out the ceiling in that area to make sure that we're not seeing any water intrusion. If we see that there's been water intrusion in the basement, we're going to go check out the basement to see if there's any water stains, if there's any evidence of a maybe waterproofing system in the basement, a sump pump, all of those things. So basically, we're really going off of the residential property disclosure, which, you know, these home sellers are required to fill out and required to fill out truthfully as well. So they can't just necessarily throw down whatever they want on there. It is a legal document that they are required to fill out truthfully. So, you know, that's a good start. And then obviously checking out the things that we want most in our home, obviously the, you know, aesthetics and appliances, flooring, things of that nature. Make sure everything's in good working order. Age of mechanicals, HVAC, and roof, and things of that nature. It's hard to see all these things in a 15 to 30 minute showing. And that has been another issue that we've run into over the last 4 or 5 years in this hot market, is when you see it once, that's probably the only time you're going to see it until you're in contract and for your inspections. So just want to make sure that you're taking that 15 to 30 minutes and really taking a look at the property when you're there and taking a look at all aspects. And that's another thing that I'm there for as well. You know, obviously, I'm not a licensed inspector or anything like that, but I'm familiar with homes and familiar with properties and things of that nature. So I'm able to see some of the things that maybe a normal home buyer wouldn't notice first walkthrough. So.
Yeah, man, that sounds great. I actually did not know that about the residential property disclosure. So learn something new every day. I know sometimes we'll get those over in our contracts and stuff and have a few key points to look for on the lender side of things. You know, not to get into all that, but obviously, you know, we check to see if it's on public water, public septic, you know, or public sewer, those sort of things, because obviously each loan program has a little bit of different tests and things that need to be done if you're on a private water source or a private sewer system. So, but yeah, man, that's awesome. What are some tips and tricks you have for people when they're out there on the home hunt? Anything that you've noticed? Anything that helps, you know, maybe, you know, get your offer accepted, or, you know, figure out which property works best for you?
Definitely. So there's been a lot of different things, again, over this, in this hot market. And again, I've only been licensed since 2020. So this is kind of the only market that I'm familiar with, is this hot market that we've been in over the last 5 years. But if you find that property that you're really locked in on, you feel that it's the one, there's a couple of different things that you can absolutely do to make your offer stand out, make you feel more comfortable that you're going to be able to succeed in finding this property or being in getting a contract on this property. You know, obviously people go to price first and foremost, upping the price. But that isn't necessarily always the most advantageous for the seller. It really just depends on their situation. If we have a seller that is looking to downsize and get out of this property immediately, a quicker closing date than what was in your head may be something that's advantageous and get your offer accepted. You know, having inspections is key, but having a waiver of the request to remedy period. So telling sellers that you're willing to have the inspection, but also willing to take on the property as is condition, something that's advantageous. And so I think that, you know, just being confident when you go see this property, I think it can be pretty overwhelming when you go see two or three or four or five properties in a single day. So just being confident when you're walking in there, knowing that this may not be the one, but if it is, you are confident, ready to go and make that offer happen.
Yeah. And I mean, that piggybacks kind of on the pre-approval process as well, and how important that is to get started there. Because like you said, being confident, you know, when you go out and look at these properties and already having an idea in mind of what your budget is and what you can do. And I know I didn't really touch on that a whole bunch in the pre-approval process, but I mean, we do both would agree that that is one of the most important things that you can do to get the process started. You know, skipping that step is not very smart, not for you, not for your real estate agent, because you guys could be going out and looking at properties that are just not going to make any sense for you whatsoever, because maybe you can't afford them. Maybe you've paid too much attention to Zillow or a realtor and you think the payment's going to be a lot lower than it really is. So it's really important to have those conversations with your lender, because again, it helps you shop with confidence. And when you go out, you know, hey, you know, this fits these parameters. You know, we've already looked, it has the amount of bedrooms we're looking for, has the amount of, you know, square feet, acreage, whatever you're looking for in those situations. And it's in my budget and I know I can afford it. And if we want to put an offer on it, we can do that right now. You know, especially like Zach said, in this hot market, things are going fast. There's not a whole lot of inventory out there. So when you do find something you like, you got to be able to jump on it. And having that pre-approval in hand ready to go is really important in those moments.
Definitely. Definitely. So, you know, just moving on to actually making that offer. I talked about it a little bit already. A few of the pieces that can be advantageous for sellers, but there is a lot of different moving parts in this contract. In the standard Columbus Board of Realtors contract that I use, it is a 22-page document, and there is a lot of words in there, and so it can be a little bit overwhelming if you're not ready as a home buyer, and not knowing, I think, of some of the key points in there as well. And so touching on those, obviously, like I mentioned already, price is going to be the number one thing that a lot of home buyers and sellers talk about first and foremost with an offer. When they get an offer, how much is it for? You know what I mean? I think people equate price with home buying, with all of that. So moving on from there, you need to determine if you're going to be buying your property, you know, with cash or with financed. Obviously, kind of what we've talked about from here is getting pre-approved and using financing to buy the property. But that is a piece of the puzzle in the purchase contract. If you're paying cash, you need to make sure that's specified in there. If you're financing, you definitely need to make sure that there's a financing contingency in there to protect yourself if you're not able to fulfill that financing. So that takes me on to contingencies. That's a little bit of a jargon real estate word. Contingency is a piece of a clause in the contract that allows you to withdraw under specific circumstances. So that financing contingency is one that I see pretty much most often. Basically, if you're not able to secure financing, whether that's something that happened with your own finances through that process or whatever it may be, if you're not able to secure financing for any reason, you are able to back out of the contract with no penalty to you, minus maybe your earnest money deposit, depending on the timing of everything. But you won't be on the hook for the full purchase price out of your pocket if you have that contingency in there. If you do not have that contingency in there and you're not able to fulfill your financing, it is a legal document, so you may be, you know, on the hook for that entire purchase price out of your pocket. So always make sure that you have that financing contingency in there to protect yourself. Another contingency that I see pretty often is your home sale contingency. So basically, it is if a buyer is in contract to sell his current property, if that current property does not end up selling, he is allowed to back out of the current property that he's attempting to buy. Basically just protects the buyer from having two mortgages, having two properties. And most times that buyer likely can't afford the second property without selling the first property to begin with. So having that contingency in there protects you from having two properties, having two mortgages, and having to fulfill that contract entirely. So we did talk a little bit about inspections and requests to remedy as well. Usually that is about a 7-day process once that contract is accepted. So basically you'll have 7 days to hire a licensed inspector to go in there and check out every inch of the home. So this is going to be a deep dive on the RPD, the residential property disclosure, and a deep dive on your walkthrough as well. You're going to get pictures. You're going to get so much feedback that probably more feedback than you need to know, to be honest with you. But it is nice information to have firsthand right there. You can kind of reference back and make decisions based on that. But then the next part of the inspections is called the request to remedy. And so basically anything that comes back on that inspection report, you will be able to, as a buyer, request that the seller remedy these items before closing. And so this becomes a second, you know, negotiation of the in-person or the in-contract portion of this. So basically you're going to be negotiating on things that you want done, and the seller can, you know, say yes, they can say no, they can tell you that they'll give you money to do those things. It's all a negotiation. And so advantageous for sellers is to not have to do anything, you know, prior to selling their property. They could see this entire inspection report and say they're not going to do anything. But obviously it's a negotiation. There's two parties of negotiating power. And so, you know, everything is negotiable there. And that's another thing that your real estate agent does for you is go to bat in that request a remedy and make sure that the things that matter most to you on that inspection report that showed up and need to be fixed are fixed, or you're getting a credit back towards that purchase price, or you're getting cash back at closing to get those taken care of. So it's an important step. And again, in this hot market, I've seen clients waive the inspection entirely. So they're literally buying the property with zero knowledge at all. I've seen clients waive the request to remedy, but still have the inspections done just for their own personal knowledge. Again, it's all negotiable, and things are very custom tailored when writing offers. There's a lot of different things, moving parts, and things that you can do, you know, that are dependent on your own specific situation in general. So
would you say for yourself personally, because I know we do see on the lending side, I mean, we don't deal with inspections a whole bunch, not obviously required on our side of things. You know, I know you mentioned waiving those. Is that a recommendation of yours? I know, you know, obviously in this market that can entice your seller a little bit more, because not only if you waive that inspection, are you waiving that request to remedy? They are not going to have to do anything. You know, what are your thoughts there? Because I know that's probably a hot debate in the real estate world on whether or not it's smart to waive inspections or not smart.
It really just depends on the situation. It really does. I don't think I will ever advise a client to waive inspections entirely. I don't think I would ever do that, because I think it's great knowledge to have, just to have in your hand. Even if you waive the request to remedy, it's great knowledge to have. So you know that in 2 years you may need a new roof, or 5 years you may need a new HVAC system. It's good to have. It's good information to have and to be able to make an informed decision on your property. Waiving that entirely, you're in the dark. You have no idea.
Yeah.
And so it can be a little scary, especially with large purchase prices, especially when you start paying over ask and things of that nature as well, combining all of those things together.
Yeah. Seems like a very fine line to balance in this market, you know, getting too aggressive and wanting to be a little too, I need this house, you know, kind of in that craze where you're willing to do certain things, you know, that maybe you shouldn't. So definitely good to obviously have a professional there to kind of navigate you through that. Cause, I mean, we have seen buyers do it. We've seen, getting into other things, you know, appraisal gaps and those sort of things, you can just get yourself on the hook for, you know, quite a few things out there that maybe are not always the smartest idea. So always good to kind of take a step back and really look at the situation, maybe with more of an objective point of view, and kind of remove emotions from it. You know, cause no house is worth getting yourself in a crappy position, I would say. But then there's also the other fine line of being a little too picky and, wanting a little too much. You know, you're never going to find anything that's perfect. You know, that's just not the nature of how this works. So, definitely a dichotomy there to balance between the two, you know, being overly picky and, you know, overly cautious, and then just, you know, being a little too carefree and throwing caution to the wind, you know, whatever, you know, I don't care what the house looks like, you know,
just let it all fly.
Yeah. That would not be me. I'll tell you that I would definitely be getting inspection
for sure. And I think a little bit of the, inspection process, when I see inspection reports come back, generally speaking, 90% of the items on there mean absolutely nothing. And so when buyers see all of the items that come back and they see and they read some of the things that it, as a real estate agent and as, you know, me on your team, it's my job to kind of for a lack of a better term, talk you off the edge. You know, make sure that you're understanding that some of these things don't matter and some of these things do matter. And that is exactly what we need to tackle, is the things that matter. Don't get hung up and negotiate over $50 repairs, $100 repairs on a $225,000 home purchase. So,
yeah. Yep. Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
So moving on, another aspect of the offer is going to be your earnest money deposit. Basically, this is just a good faith deposit that goes back to your purchase price, or goes towards your purchase price at closing. So basically, I would equate it as a security deposit when you're renting. So you are approved for a property for a rental property, and now you have to give them a security deposit. And once you move out, they're going to return that security deposit to you minus any damages or repairs. In this instance, obviously, you don't have any damages or repairs. This is just showing the seller that you are locked in on this purchase, that you now have your own funds in the game. You have a little bit of skin in the game for yourself, and shows the seller that you're serious. And so basically, once that contract period is up and we get to closing, you'll get that check back in full, and that will get applied to your closing funds, any funds that you need to bring to the closing table as the borrower. So
absolutely. Just as a little segue in there, not to get too in depth on the earnest money, but a couple tips and tricks. Obviously, you want to make sure from a lending side of it, because of what Zach mentioned there, it is going to be applied to your closing. There are some things that you need to be aware of. We've had people that have put down earnest money who are not on the contract. Typically, you want to stay away from that. If you don't share banking or those sort of things, you know, having, you know, your parents put down an earnest money deposit for you, you know, if that money is being applied to your closing, you have to consider that that money has to be verified from a lender's perspective. So just be cautious with that. You know, make sure the money comes from you if you have it. Don't do any weird deposits or anything. You know, hey, I have $1,000 I can do earnest money, but it's, you know, cash under my mattress that I'm just going to put in my account and pay you guys, you know, those sort of things. And we can get into all of the nuances of that, but, just a few things to look out for when it comes to earnest money. You know, make sure the money's coming from you if that's something you're going to do. You know, you don't want to get that money from somebody else, because we will have to verify that, or else it'll just be removed from the contract in the first place. So
definitely. And usually I tell clients to be about 1% of the purchase price. So if it's anything, you know, 200, 250 grand, somewhere around there, $1,000 will do. Obviously, that's a little bit less than 1%. But once you get up into the larger home purchases, maybe 500 grand, 600 grand, 1% is usually a good rule of thumb. Sellers like to see deposited immediately upon acceptance. So moving on, the last thing that I kind of want to touch on with the offer is going to be chattel. So that is another real estate jargon term. Basically, that is just anything in the house that is not affixed to the property. So that is going to be any appliances, fridge, you know, washer and dryer, dishwasher, things like that. Any, you know, household items that they have that you may walk through and see that they have a really nice poster that you want. And so that would need to be included in the offer as chattel. And so all of those things that you want to be conveyed with the property that are not affixed need to be included in the purchase contract as well. I've seen real estate agents have to eat $3,000 out of their commission because they did not put the washer and dryer in to the contract, but obviously the buyer wanted them in the contract. And so when they got done with closing, they came to the house, you know, to move in, they had the keys, they were ready to go. They don't have a washer and dryer. And so now the agent has to buy their washer and dryer because they didn't put that in their, you know, contract. And so those are all things that we're looking for and making sure that we're doing right by clients for. And obviously, again, something that probably most home buyers aren't thinking about when they're walking through the property. They probably are thinking that all of the things that are in the property right now are going to be in there when I buy it as well. So just another piece of information that I like to touch on with clients.
Absolutely. Seems like a good call, because, you know, some people fall in love with, you know, we had a client who had bought a house down in Florida who loved all the furniture, and they made sure to put that in the offer, you know, and so definitely something to be aware of, you know, because if you're falling in love with something by the way that it's, you know, set up or, you know, those sort of things, you definitely want to make sure you include that, you know, in your contract, like Zach said. So great points there.
Absolutely. So basically, just finishing up on the offer, you know, I've touched on this a little bit, but what does a good agent do for you when you're making an offer? It's really just knowing your market to be as competitive as possible and knowing what's in your contract, knowing your client, knowing what their best interests are for you, for their situation. As we've touched on a little bit already, every client situation is a little bit different. And so knowing your market, knowing your client, and, you know, knowing the things that you're working with are key as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. Well, you know, kind of to take a segue into that, you know, obviously you guys have heard, you know, what happens when you make an offer. Now let's talk about, you know, what happens when your offer is accepted. You know, I don't, you know, I'll let Zach kind of cover what goes on his side of the process once a contract is accepted. But that's kind of where we step back in as the lender side of things. You know, we'll typically step out as soon as the pre-approval process is done, you know, let you go on your house hunt with your real estate agent. If you need us for any reason, any questions or anything, we're obviously there, but nothing really for us to do until you do get in contract on a property. At which point, you know, what does that look like for you? So, you know, most typically we'll get a call or a text from the buyer, say, hey, we put a contract, you know, we put an offer in on this house, it got accepted. And then I'll say, okay, awesome. Let's get everything started. Reach out to the real estate agent, say, hey, can we get the contract over? So once we do get the contract over, there's a couple of key things that we go into with the process. So we'll typically collect some income documentations or income documents and just generalized documents from the borrower to begin with. So usually your core, your base that we always get is a copy of your driver's license, 2 months worth of bank statements, most recent bank statements, 30 days worth of pay stubs, and then W-2s. So we'll collect your last 2 years W-2s as well. So once you submit all that documentation over, we'll begin with your disclosure process. Essentially, what the disclosure process is, we take all that property specific information, we'll go in, we'll put in your purchase price amount, we'll put in your down payment, you know, we'll quote you an interest rate, all those different things. We'll make sure the property taxes are accurate for that property specifically. The only thing going in into your disclosures that would not be accurate would be your homeowner's insurance. That is something that we allow you to shop for throughout the process. So we'll kind of do just a base estimate, just kind of depending on where your purchase price is, try to get it, you know, in a realm of, you know, what's likely going to be. That way, when you look at your full payment, you do have an idea of what that's going to be each month. So once we have all that property specific information in there, we'll send out your disclosure package, which is going to include a lot of documents. I'm going to include your loan application, going to include your intent to proceed, your LE, all of those things. And so, you know, once you get that, once you sign that, that is basically your acknowledgement that you are choosing to move forward with this home purchase. Now, as a caveat to that, this does not mean that you are locked into this. You have the ability, like Zach said, if something comes up in your purchase contract and, you know, inspections don't go well and you no longer want to purchase this property, you are not bound to this loan by signing these documents. These are just documents that we have to get signed in order for us to even proceed. They are basically your acknowledgement that you did apply for this loan and would like to move forward. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, sometimes we'll have those conversations. They'll be, well, we don't want to sign this. You know, if this is going on and it's not that at all, if you decide in a week that inspections are bad, you want to get out of the property, you're more than able to walk away. Those disclosures are not that. So until you sign your final closing disclosures at closing, you know, those sort of things, you know, you have the ability to walk away from this loan. We've had people do it, you know, at every step of the process. So there are, you know, contingencies and things that get you out of that, like Zach said. So don't feel like once you sign these disclosures that you're locked in and have no ability to get out should you need to.
So if that does happen, what would the buyer be facing? I guess if somebody had a bad inspection come back and maybe the appraisal has already been done, what would that look like for a buyer? What would be their, you know, kind of out of pocket, or what would their consequences be?
Well, kind of next step was going to be talking about the things that we do order. So I would assume every lender is different. As for us and what we charge as a lender, the only upfront fee that we have is an appraisal fee. So, you know, like Zach said about the earnest money deposit, this is something from a lender perspective that just gets you a little skin in the game. You know, because in Zach's you know, instance, we have had people that, you know, just decide, you know, whatever the reason may be, that they want to get out of it. And if us as the lender take on every appraisal fee, you know, there's a good chance we might be out of that. So that is your skin in the game as a client, which then brings us to our next point. We'll typically wait on inspections a little bit until, or not wait on inspections, we'll typically wait on the appraisal until the inspection has been done. So that's a conversation I'll have. Hey, you know, when's your inspection being done? Oh, it's being done on Monday. Results should be back Tuesday, Wednesday. Okay, perfect. Let's hold off on the appraisal for now, because obviously an inspection costs you money and an appraisal costs you money. We're not going to try to double dip on you, you know, and make you spend money on an appraisal if the inspection comes back, you know, less than favorable and you decide this house is just not worth it. I don't want to be here, you know. Our goal is not to make you have to spend money. So that, you know, we do take that into account and keep that in mind. So now if you were further along in the process and, you know, for some reason something comes back with the appraisal, there's some sort of repairs or, you know, the value comes in less or something like that, and you decide, you know, let's say, for instance, you know, the appraisal comes in $5,000 less and the seller says, I'm not budging. You're either going to cover that or, you know, we'll move on or whatever the case may be. Not saying that's always the case, but just on this example, you would be out that appraisal fee. So whatever, you know, once the appraisal is ordered and the appraiser goes out, that obviously becomes a cost to you. It's not something we can get back. So that is, again, why we are a little cautious up front. You know, we try to be mindful of our clients. We're not trying to just freely spend your money. You know, we want to make sure that it does pass those inspections, that you feel comfortable moving forward. And then at that point, you know, typically we'll order the appraisal, because most normal inspection periods, I would say, what, Zach, 3 to 7 days after contract is how long they give you. So you're not missing a whole lot of time if we do wait. You know, most appraisals come back in 7 days anyway. So it's a very fast process, very fast turnaround. So usually worth the wait for you guys to make sure that, you know, everything looks good inspection wise before we send the appraiser out there. So along with ordering your appraisal once you are disclosed, because that is the key, we need your intent to proceed. We need you giving your consent that, hey, I am applying for this loan. I'm ready to move forward. At that point, we can charge you your appraisal fee and move on with that part. We're also going to order title, which I know Zach and I are both kind of answer a little bit of what the title company does at a later point in this podcast. But we do order title work on the property. You know, that's a key component to this, to make sure there's free and clear title and whatever is attached to that property is being taken care of by the current seller. They're also going to act as kind of a middleman for us. They're going to, you know, do your closing and those sort of things, which again, we can get into. But, you know, once you're disclosed, those are the two next steps, is we're going to order title and we're going to order your appraisal. From there, it goes into, you know, loan processing. So there is a loan processor that works on every file. They are kind of the mediator between the loan officer and the underwriter. They're going to help with collecting documentation. They're going to help with making sure the file has all of the necessary components it needs to be approved. And once all of those steps are met, they're going to send that loan off to the underwriter. So again, as we talked about in the pre-approval process, you know, our loans are run through a, what we call an AUS, an automated underwriting system. So we'll always produce findings for our underwriters, and then they will go through that underwriting list and condition us based on what that underwriting system says we need. So if they look at your income and say, you know, you're a W-2 employee, they're going to require 2 years W-2s, 30 days worth of pay stubs. That's why we get the documentation up front. It's our baseline documentation that we need for almost every client. When the underwriter looks at the file, they're going to come back with what's called a conditional approval. A conditional approval is basically a statement that says you are approved for this loan once these conditions are met. Every loan has different sets of conditions, but most of them are pretty basic. You're going to see title work conditions. So that's why we order the title. We have to make sure that all the title work is clear, those sort of things. There's going to be appraisal conditions. We got to make sure the appraisal comes back. Everything's good to go with that. And then there's going to be any additional borrower conditions based on the documentation that you already provided. You know, for instance, if, you know, we get your income and your year to date's a little low because you received a raise in April, our pay stubs are not going to show that you received a raise in April. It's just going to show that your year to date's a little short. So the underwriter is mostly going to say, hey, order a verification of employment to find out why this borrower's year to date's low. Once we get that back, it's going to clearly show received a $2 raise in April. That's why for the first 4 months you were making less. That explains why the year to date's a little bit off comparative to where it should be based on your current documentation. You know, just there's all kinds of things that can come back on that. For the most part, it's all pretty simple. You're going to do a lot of letters of explanation. So anytime there's inquiries on your credit, anytime there's addresses on your credit that don't match the application, you know, just kind of your basic things go into that. So, you know, that's when typically myself or, you know, our processor will reach out, get you guys a list, say, hey, here's what we need to complete for the underwriter, you know, in order to get this loan cleared. So skip ahead to the next step. Once the appraisal comes in, once the title work comes in, once we collect all of your documentation, we're going to submit that back to the underwriter, at which point they'll do another review. If there's anything additional that they may need, they'll come back again. We'll gather all that stuff, submit it back. And typically we try to get everything clear to close by that second or third, look by the underwriter. So once we do that final submission, the underwriter is going to come back and say this loan is clear to close. At which point, you know, we'll go into the scheduling of everything. We'll start working on that, you know, and those sort of things. So
a lot going on the backside of things. Once, you know, obviously there's, and that's your side. And so, moving on to my side of things, while all that's going on post contract acceptance, we also have some stuff going on my side as well. And this usually is about a 30 to 45 day process all in all, from contract acceptance to closing day. All of this stuff is happening usually within 30 to 45 days. So the number one thing, as I've kind of mentioned a little bit already, that I'm going to be taking a look at is going to be that inspection report. We're going to review it together, and we're going to determine what matters on there to you as the buyer and what does not matter. And from there, make a request to remedy to the seller. And it, again, this is the second large negotiation period of the contract process. So there's a lot of different avenues that this can go at this point. And so just want to make sure that as the buyer, you are requesting the things that matter the very most to you, and that matter the most to your wallet as well. And so just want to be able to protect yourself, you know, 2 to 3 years down the road. If a roof is going out, want to make sure that you're trying to negotiate that aspect. So from there, I'm going to be, as Sam mentioned, going to be talking to the title company as well, just if anything's popping up. Obviously, they are an intermediary between every party of the transaction, between the buyer and the seller. Have no, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Preference towards either one. Obviously, just want to make sure that the transaction goes smoothly and funds are being collected and dispersed as the contract reads. And so from there, you're going to be doing a final walkthrough, you know, 2 days, 3 days before closing. And at that point, you are just going to be determining that everything is in is the shape that you're ready to take it on as. All of the things that you asked for in the contract, all the chattel, all of those items are still there. And obviously that this property is in good enough condition to go ahead and get closed. So
absolutely, man. Absolutely. Yeah. you know, obviously our big thing is going to be communication throughout. I know we already kind of touched on that a little bit, and I know obviously what we just covered, when you do go into contract, there are a lot of components to that. And it can sound extremely overwhelming, as obviously we can expect. But again, our goal and our job is to make that as simple as a process for you as possible, keep you informed every single step of the way, let you know when there's issues that may arise or things that may pop up, because that's just the reality of this business. There's going to be things that come up, whether it be appraisal issues, whether it be title issues, whether it be issues with maybe things that we didn't discuss in the pre-approval process, and maybe you forgot to mention to me, that come up, you know, once you are in contract, because those things do happen as well. You know, and unfortunately, you know, kind of like how we talked about just kind of in the beginning with the auto loan, this is going to be a much deeper dive into your entire finances and just kind of your life in general, in all honesty. You know, there's certain reports that we pull on our end. You know, we do a credit report, we do a fraud report. You know, there's a lot that goes into it to make sure that all of this information is accurate that you are giving us. You know, and that's kind of one of the things that you know, gets a little bit lost in translation throughout this process. And I like to, you know, reemphasize with our clients is that you guys have to understand that just because you may talk to myself, you may talk to Zach, you know, when it comes to getting a mortgage, you know, the people that are going to be lending you that money are never going to have a conversation with you whatsoever. At the end of the day, you know what I mean? So the underwriter, you're never going to have a conversation with them. The investor who purchases the loan on the back end and collects your payment each month, you're never going to have a conversation with them. So you have to understand that this stuff has to make sense on paper, because you can give any explanation you want over the phone. You can tell me, hey, this is the reason that I had $10,000 of cash deposited in my account. And that's all great. But the only thing the investor is going to see is $10,000 worth of cash and not knowing where that money came from. So we can explain our way, you know, as far as we want, but ultimately, you know, these people that are working on the back end, they know what is put in front of them. And so we have to be extremely mindful of those things. And so that's why we always try to communicate and do those things in the forefront, is to say, hey, don't make these mistakes. Don't do these things, because again, you know, I'm here to help and I'm here to support you, but we also have guidelines to meet, and we also have people that are going to view these loans who are never going to talk to you, don't know you from anybody. So any of those explanations that they can come up with in their head could be true for where that $10,000 came from, or, you know, fill in anything. It could all, you know, make sense. And so we got to make it make sense for anybody who is to view the loan down the line, who will never have a conversation with you. So just be mindful of those things as well.
Most definitely. And I would say a large number of the, you know, hiccups that pop up throughout the process are solvable. I would say a lot of, you know, 90 to 95% of the hiccups that pop up are going to be able to be solved. Just need to have a little bit of, you know, work on everybody's, on everybody's front. So with that being said, I think we just kind of want to talk a little bit about some of the most common mistakes, you know, that we see in the process and how you can avoid them. Obviously, like I just mentioned, a lot of them can be solvable, but some of them are not solvable. And they can 100% be avoided. And the number one that we kind of talked about already is starting the home search without being pre-approved. Not knowing your budget prior to, you know, going out and seeing properties or writing offers. It's just wasting your time, wasting the lender's time, wasting a real estate agent's time. You're not going to be able to be approved for the property. So why even be interested in it? Just want to make sure that you know how much home you're able to afford before you get started with anything else.
Yeah. I mean, and not only that, but also just, you know, especially in this market, you're going to get laughed at if you try to put an offer in without a pre-approval letter. Let's just get real. I mean, most people, you know, they don't want their time wasted. And I think we can all relate to that on some level. Nobody wants their time wasted. So, and I know that, you know, it may not always be that thought process for you. And that's, I guess, why we're here to, you know, let you know that. I know, you know, most people are not setting out to waste people's time, and you have your reasons for why you don't want to get pre-approved. And, you know, I don't want my credit touched and this, that, or the other. But ultimately, you have to look at it from a different perspective, because there's so many people involved in this that, you know, it is a time waster, especially if you get into contract and you think the payment's going to be something and it's not. You know, maybe you're not able to afford it, you know, on paper for one. Maybe you're like, this is way too high for me to even afford. Even if you could afford it on paper, maybe you're like, I don't want to make this payment. You know, that would be an issue as well. We try to do a great job of digging in on those things in the beginning to have those conversations that might be some of that way we can kind of uncover some of those 5% that may not be solvable from the beginning, to let you know, hey, you know, you're going to have to wait this amount of time before you're going to be ready. But yes, make sure you get pre-approved. Make sure you're not wasting everybody's time, especially your own. You know, me, that's most important, you know, because we do see people that, you know, get all geared up for these things and then, you know, are let down, and, you know, it's unfortunate, but yeah, could be avoided.
And disappointment is not a good feeling either. Like, you just, nobody wants to be disappointed in any aspect. And so that's the big feeling that I see when people are out there searching for property, without being pre-approved. So yeah, another one that I've talked about already today is skipping inspections entirely. Just not having an idea of what's going on in the property that you're about to buy. Again, if you skip your inspections entirely, you could miss out on the information that your HVAC system is literally about to go out And in 6 months, you're going to have to replace that thing. And so even if you, again, waive your request to remedy, but still have the inspections done just for your own knowledge, you have that peace of mind that you know what's going on in that property below the bone or below the, you know, aesthetics in the bones. And if the property has good bones, obviously things can be done to the aesthetic part of it as well. So just knowing if it has good bones or if it's going to need, you know, surgery here in a couple months.
So. No, especially, for, you know, I don't want to group everybody in this, but we do work with a lot of first time home buyers. And when we work with a lot of first time home buyers, we typically go routes of, you know, FHA with a minimal down payment percentage, or we go USDA with zero down, or we'll look into down payment assistance programs. And all of those common denominators are that typically when you go out and buy a first home, a lot of the people that we work with haven't been saving for the last 5 to 10 years to make this purchase. It's something they, I can't stay in my apartment, I got to get out of here, or I'm tired of living with my parents, I got to get out of here, I'm ready to move. You know, and a lot of those people don't have these funds set back. So how silly would it be to purchase a home and not know what you, you know, not know anything with the inspections, and then now in 6 months you have to pay, you know, for a $3,000 new water heater or whatever the case may be because you didn't do that on the forefront. So obviously very important as well, especially for first time home buyers, because a lot of the times we, you know, most first time home buyers do not have just this readily access to loads of cash on the back end to make, you know, these things happen. And so, you know, a little bit of cost on the forefront to get the inspection is far going to outweigh the larger purchases, you know, 3, 6, 9 months down the road, or at least prepare you for them should that come up. You know, so definitely some thought there as well. So a couple of things on the lending side of things, a couple of big no-nos, and not necessarily deal killers, but some things that will definitely throw a wrench in your plans. And when I say wrench means, you know, usually we're going to have to get, you know, an extension of the contract, which never usually makes any parties happy, because usually when you have a closing date on the contract, most people are expecting to abide by that. So a couple of these things to avoid. Making large purchases on your credit during the process. We have had lots of clients who will reach out and ask, hey, we want to buy new furniture for the property. Hey, we want to do this, you know, and we're still 3 weeks out from closing and they want to go put, you know, $3,000, $4,000 on a credit card to go get, you know, their new couch and whatever. And so, you know, I would say in these cases, not only, I wouldn't say in every case it's don't make that purchase, but have that conversation with your real estate or with your lender first and foremost. You know, if you're somebody who is close on your debt to income ratios, especially on your back end, if we've stretched your budget, you know, pretty far to meet conventional or to meet FHA guides on the back end, and we're going to be very close, definitely have that conversation with your lender, because that might just be enough to put you over the top to where, you know, you may not be able to afford that house. Just so you guys know, each loan program, if you are over, I think it's within maybe a 5% or 6% of that, you know, of that range. So for conventional, if you're over a 45% back end, you know, even though they allow up to 50, they will ask us to do a credit refresh at closing to make sure that none of those debts have changed during the process. And if you've gone out and put $10,000 on a credit card and not told your lender, and now your payment's $200 a month more than what we originally had on there, that has the potential to put you in a bad position for your debt to income ratios. So, you know, make sure that you're having those conversations. And if that is something you want to do, talk to your lender about it first. Say, hey, you know, am I able to do this? And we can obviously take a look at those things. And if it's not going to affect it, you know, and not going to put you in a position where it puts you over ratio, you know, we'll obviously communicate that with you. So just, again, open lines of communication on both fronts is vitally important, because I know we've stressed communication on our side of things. We've said, hey, that's going to be our job for you, you know, what we're going to provide to you guys. But if you could also provide, you know, not even just for Zachary, but any professionals that you work with, if you can provide open lines of communication with them, you guys have to remember, we're here to help you. This is about you. It's not about us. And if you come to us and talk to us, we can brainstorm ideas and ways to work around certain things. So,
and a lot of the items that we run into, we've seen before. You know what I mean? This is the first time, maybe a first time home buyer is dealing with this, but this is your seventh time or eighth time. So you have ideas and things to be able to help in that aspect that have seen already help other people. So
yeah, it makes it very easy. It's very nice when we have clients who will pick up the phone and just call and talk about what's going on with them and what they're considering doing, because it makes our life a lot easier. It's going to make your life a lot easier. And I can assure you, I will say this with utmost confidence, there's nothing that you're going to do in your time in your loan process that we will not find out about. There's just nothing. I'm telling you, this business is so extensive nowadays because of what happened back in 2008. There are so many guidelines in place that everything is checked and double checked and triple checked. So if you think that you're going to pull a fast one over on your lender, if you think that you can do something and skate it under the bus, it's not going to happen. I can assure you, we have clients that maybe don't try to do it maliciously, but they try to do it because they don't think it's a big deal and that we won't find out. And I can assure you, we will find out. It's just the nature of the business. You don't lend out $150,000 to $400,000 consistently without double checking that, you know, the people, you know, meet those guidelines on the back end. So that brings me to another thing. The next one is quitting or switching your job in the loan process. This is a big one. This is one that we will 100% find out about because we do a verbal verification of your employment prior to closing. We're going to make sure that the employment that we qualified you on, that you're literally getting this house on, is still in place and that you're still earning that income. And it's honestly a little upsetting the amount of times that this happens, that people will quit and not tell us or switch jobs. And again, you know, we're not here to deter you from something. If you come to us and say, hey, I got this job offer and it's $5 more an hour than what I'm making right now, we're going to be like, absolutely, go take that job. But let's have a conversation with the listing agent. Let's have a conversation with the seller. Let's have a conversation with your buyer's agent. Say, hey guys, listen, they have a great opportunity in front of them. They have a job that they can take. They need an answer now. They're going to have to switch in the middle of this process. Hey, we need a week extension. Hey, we need a 10-day extension. That way we can gather the proper documentation that we need. But let's not, you know, hurt you in the process. We're not going to tell you don't take the job, but it's open lines of communication. Again, it allows us to be honest and upfront with everybody, because when you go switch a job and we find out 2 days before closing, and now we come to everybody who's already expecting to close within 2 days, and we tell them, hey, sorry guys, we got 10 days more on this, I can guarantee you there's going to be a lot of unhappy folks when those conversations start to happen. So again, we will find out. Please just have that conversation with your lender. We are not against you. We are on your team. We are here to help. So just use that as a resource.
And generally speaking, human beings are okay with things that get messed up, or they're okay with, you know, things like that. They just need to be communicated. So if in that situation, if a seller need or if a buyer needs an extension by 10 days and it's communicated right up front, usually the seller and the listing agent are going to be receptive to that. Now, 2 days before closing, like you just mentioned, likely aren't going to be as receptive. So again, just open communication. And again, most human beings are understanding of challenges and obstacles. So
yeah. Yep. I wholeheartedly agree. This business, for everything that goes into it, you know, people are generally very understanding. You know, we don't see a whole lot of sellers pull out if there is an extension needed, but Lord, I mean, it is better to just give them a heads up. You know, people are very understanding. Like you said, if something comes up, if you say, hey, I just found a new job and they're paying me $5 more an hour, I'm going to make, you know, whatever that is, more a year, most sellers would be like, oh yeah, absolutely. Not, oh no,
can't do that.
This deal's more, this deal's more important. I need this, you know, now. And even if they do need it now, you know, most people still, you know, take the time to be understanding. So, quitting or switching jobs mid-process. Again, if you're going to switch jobs, it needs to be something that's better than what you are, because that's another thing. If you're taking a downgraded position, and unless you're, let's say you travel for work and you have, you know, unless it makes logical sense, let's say you travel for work and you have kids, you're gone 6 months out of the year, you're like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to take, you know, a couple dollars less an hour to be home to where I don't have to travel, then okay, that makes sense. But if you're just like, you know, you work a job and you're just like, yeah, I work too many hours, I want to back down, you know, I want to make less money and work less hours, and we use you to qualify on that income, that's going to present a problem for your loan application if you just decide that that's just something you don't want anymore. So something to keep in mind there as well. So again, just communicate. The other one is cash deposits. This is a big one for most people. You know, you would be surprised the amount of people that we talk to on a week-to-week basis that do not trust the banks, that do not want their money anywhere near a bank or whatever the case may be. And so there's something that people call mattress money, which is just money that you have at home, whether that's under your mattress or in a safe or wherever it is. Guys, that money is undocumented. No matter what way you try to slice that cake, there is no way to say that where that money came from. You could have gotten $10,000 from your parents given to you. That money could be yours that you've made doing side jobs. It doesn't matter. Let your imagination go whichever way you want it to. And any of those could be possibilities for where that money came from, because we have no way to say for certain where it came from. Cash has no way to document it. So when you go put $10,000 in your bank account, just understand that the underwriter, if you say, hey, this is money that I took out from, you know, side jobs, they have no way to tell that for sure. So in this business, everything needs to be documented. So it's just something to keep in mind. If you're going to do cash deposits, if you have money and you're considering buying a home, probably do that way ahead of time. And something you want to get in your bank account and get seasoned for the next few months, next 6 months, whatever the case may be. You know, I don't speak to the non-trust of banks. I don't know. That's, you know, between if you're one of those people out there and that's something that you struggle with, you know, that's between you and you, but you also need to consider the fact that that's not going to work for your loan process. So, I mean, if you want to, buy a home, you really can't have your cake and eat it too. I would suggest getting that money inside of a bank account and letting it season for a couple of months, you know, and not just going and depositing it all at once. So, because that would be not good. So just something to think about with cash.
And at that point, if you let it season for 6 months, you're going to have only another probably 30 to 45 more days that it's sitting in that bank account before it's spent. You know what I mean? So at the very most, it's sitting in there for 7 months or 7.5 months, and then it'll be put into the property.
Yep, absolutely. So just something to think about there, but try to avoid it if at all possible, you know, and especially if you're going to be, you know, with the hopes of this podcast is to get to you guys ahead of time before, you know, hopefully you're not consuming this a day before you're about to go put in an offer. You know what I mean? We're obviously trying to help you guys, you know, a few months to a year before the process and getting those things, you know, lined up and taken care of. And that's one of those things that would help you get the money in your bank account, let it season itself, put it away in a savings, you know, whatever you got to do. If you're worried about touching it and if it's in the account, you know, those sort of things. And maybe think about a separate bank that's not as easily accessible to you as your current checking account. You know, if that's a concern, is I'm going to spend this money, put it somewhere else that you have to literally physically go to the bank to get access to it, because I can assure you getting to the bank these days is not as easy as you think, especially, you know, with the work hours and what times they're open. You know, it can be a pain in the butt. So it's a lot harder to get access to that money when it's not just accessible by swiping a card. If you got to physically go in there and get it, you know, and if that's a concern of yours, you know, that could be something that you use and look to do. So, yeah. And I mean, other than that, I would just say the last one is moving money around undocumented. We do see that from time to time. You know, a lot of times if you're in a relationship or, you know, you do different things, you know, you guys got to consider the fact that if that person's not on the loan with you, you know, moving money from their account to your account, you know, it can just create messes. It's not something that can't be worked around. Again, a lot of these things do have workarounds to them, but, you know, we're trying to create as clean of files as possible. We're trying to create the least amount of work for you as possible as the consumer. When you get into contract and when you're moving money around from every which way, you know, it can become a lot. So it's something to consider for you guys. You know, if it's one thing, if you're moving money from your personal savings account to your personal checking frequently, those are easily documented. We just get statements and show, you know, the money transferring. But if we're talking about you're in relationships and you're moving money this way, that way, they're giving you money for this, that, the other, you know, it can become a lot. So just consider those things. And, you know, again, as I talked about in the beginning, we only collect 2 months worth of bank statements up front. So, you know, just something to keep in mind. You know, if you're doing all that activity and you know, let's say right now, hey, in spring, I'm going to start looking for a house. Okay, by December, you need to kind of cut that back and let's try to get our finances in alignment. Let's try to make things a little bit cleaner. Because when they pull my last 2 months bank statement and they go back through it, it's going to be a lot cleaner than what it has been. So just something to think about there.
Most definitely. I appreciate all those for sure. And I'm sure our listeners do as well. For sure.
Absolutely. Let's just hope they, you know, the advice is taken. So, yeah, that's the biggest thing is putting that stuff into practice. So, I know it's not easy, especially if you've been doing things a certain way your whole life. You know, if you've grown up with parents who don't believe in the banking system and you don't believe in it either, it's going to be hard for you to come to terms with putting that money in an account. But like Zach said, you know, this is we're talking about a greater goal for you. You know, this is if you, after you buy your house, want to go back to stacking up money at your house, you know, you're more than welcome to do it. It's just, you know, just be mindful of that when buying a property. So, well, brother, I think we covered kind of the basics of everything as it goes across the board. This has been a long podcast for you guys. So hopefully you stuck with us this entire time and, you know, listen to kind of all the ins and outs of what goes into it. I think, you know, moving forward, obviously we would like to do a little bit more of a deeper dive into each of these sections. Again, some of it's going to be stuff that Zach covers just by himself. Some of it'll be stuff I cover by myself, but you know, there is, again, I know we covered a lot of information, but there is, you know, there's ways to get a little bit more nuanced and dig a little bit deeper into each of these things and provide some additional value for you guys. But obviously just kind of, you know, if you've never bought a house or don't even know where to start, this should be a great, great opening podcast for you guys to at least kind of give you a sense of what those expectations should be like, you know, moving forward with that.
For sure. An hour and 20 minutes, you know, to talk about a 30 to 45 day process can be, we cut it down a lot, but there is still a lot of meat on the bone as well. A lot of information that was presented throughout this hour and 20 minutes. So again, if you guys, have any questions, any concerns, you know, anything that stood out to you while we were talking about this, feel free to, again, reach out to us directly. We'd love to answer your questions. Feel free to leave us a comment. And again, that may be something that we turn into another educational video moving forward, or, you know, whatever it is. We just want to hear from you guys. So appreciate you guys' time. And, we're looking forward to the next one.
Absolutely. Yeah, guys. I mean, obviously, if you have questions, then there's a good chance somebody else has those same questions. So don't hesitate. Put them in the comments. Let us know. Like Zach said, we'd love to probably do a Q&A episode as time goes on. So, but yeah, guys, don't forget to like, subscribe, follow, you know, share the post. Obviously, your guys' engagement and your interaction with us means everything. If there's anything else that you guys feel like we should cover, you know, anything we didn't cover here that you have questions about, just let us know. But appreciate y'all tuning in. And yeah, hopefully you guys got a lot of great value out of it.
Absolutely. That does it for this episode of Closing the Deal. Appreciate you guys. And you have another great day, another great week.
Yep. See you guys.